And a skeleton was found at La Chapelle, or Saints, in the southwest of France. And it was a very excellently preserved skeleton. I'd like you to have a look at these, because this is a suggested family group of Neanderthal man. And here we have a diagram of a skull of a Neanderthal man, which was discovered in Italy. And here is a contrast between Homo sapiens skull and a Neanderthal skull, and also a difference in the skeleton. So you might be interested to have a look at that. The main anatomical features of Neanderthal man are as follows. The skull as a whole is of large size and has thick cranial walls. The brow ridges are relatively large, huge, and they form a massive shelf of bone overhanging the orbits of the eyes. The forehead is very, very retreating, remarkably retreating. The brain case is flattened, and the bony ridges on the bone at the back, the occipital bone, are very powerfully developed for the attachment of exceptionally strong neck muscles. The occipital region of the skull projects backwards in an angular contour, and the orbits and nasal apertures are large. The upper jaw is prominent and massively built, more so, of course, than Homo sapiens, and has an inflated appearance related to the large size of the air sinuses which it contains. The palate is broad and capacious. The axis of the foramen magnum on the base of the skull is more deflected from the vertical than in Homo sapiens. You will remember that one of the factors in structural evolution that took place with the coming into being of modern man was that the skull was placed in the centre. The spinal column entered the skull in a straight line. With anthropoid ape, for example, it's at an angle, which means that the ape tends to look forward. This is a simian characteristic, and you can see that to some extent from that skeleton, Neanderthal man has a certain proclivity towards that, but not so anything like an anthropoid ape, of course. But you can see that Homo sapiens is not only a foot higher, but that the spinal column and the foramen magnum, which is the hole at the base of the skull, is balanced right in the centre of the body. Now, the only other reference I've got to make to Neanderthal man is in the size of the brain. And this is quite peculiar, because there were certain primitive appearances about it, but the size was quite large. And the average size of Neanderthal man's brain was about 1,450 cc's, which was rather much larger, or not much larger, but a bit larger than the average size of a modern human brain, which is about 1,350 cc's. Although, of course, there's an overlap in variation, but nevertheless, that's the average. Now, the anatomy of the rest of the skeleton, as you can see, shows a few interesting features. The processes, the spinous processes, are unusually long for attachment of the powerful neck muscles, and this gave rather a clumsy appearance, and the height was about 5 feet. But in spite of the fact that he only stood 5 feet, he was very, very muscular. Now incidentally, there's also a skull of Rhodesian man, which is a Homo erectus one. Well, we've passed that, so we don't need to look at that. Now, I don't want to say anything more about Neanderthal man, except to point out that there were two developments in the Neanderthal man. In the earlier Neanderthal fossils, they were a more of a generalized character. In the later period, the period before they died out, they became more specialized and exaggerated. And at the end of the Mosterian phase of Paleolithic culture, that is the stone culture of that particular kind, Neanderthal man in Europe was abruptly replaced by people of a more modern type, a European type, and there is reason to suppose that this new population, which were called the Aurignacians, because that was the type of stone culture that they had, they developed it probably elsewhere, maybe in Asia. They migrated into Europe, and of course, with their superior social organization, they quickly displaced Mosterian man or Neanderthal man and occupied his territory. The remains of the Aurignacian people have been found at Cro-Magnon in southern France, and they were a finely built race of tall and muscular people with a high cranial capacity, not distinguishable from modern man, as a matter of fact. If you look, that's the skull of Cro-Magnon man. Now, there's a lot of other stuff that I could go into. For example, there were found at Grimaldi skeletons that had a decided Negroid appearance. There's been a lot of controversy about that, whether they were of Negroid stock or whether they weren't. It's not of any great moment, but one peculiar and interesting thing of the few human remains which were found in the Magdalenian cultural phase is that some of them show anatomical characters in which they quite closely resemble the modern Eskimo. And there have been skulls found at Chanchelade in the Dordogne region of France, which display Eskimoid features. And it's suggested that with the closing, with the coming to the end of the glacial period, the last glaciation, the reindeer that were and inhabited the area at the time migrated to northern regions, and they were followed by the Eskimos. As a matter of fact, some people claim that Europe at that time was populated by Eskimos. But I would take the view that there's enough time for genetic differences, which were determined by conditions, just mere variations, not of any in great importance genetically, but the kind of variations, for example, in human races today, which have determined some people having black skins because of the adaptability to a hot, sunny climate, and the kind of characteristic adaptations of the Eskimo, which are adaptable to Arctic conditions, you know, the more rounded skull and the more narrow nasal aperture and so on. But nevertheless, that's only something which it doesn't alter very much the general consensus about what happened. Now, I'd like you to have a look at this, because this will give you an example of the kind of continuation, the kind of process from Australopithecus to Homo erectus to pre-Mosterian man to generalized Neanderthal type to specialized Neanderthal type, which was an aberrant development, and to modern man, and that'll give you some idea of how that took place. Now, it's obvious that the main factor, the important factor in the emergence of Homo sapiens is that the enormous growth of the brain in relation to the rest of the body, which had important influences on other parts of the body, but which allowed for a structural plasticity, so that man did not develop exaggerated biological attributes which determined him using them for either offense or defense or for tool making or for anything else in particular, but he was able to overcome the environment largely by using his superior intelligence. There was no need, of course, for specialized biological attributes that can be found in other animals. And qualitatively, the emergence of man is a factor in evolution which brings an entirely new quality into being. And I've said this before, and I'll explain at greater at length when I deal with the question of natural selection, that the factor which is all important now is not one of natural selection. To all intents and purposes, that has ceased to be of any crucial factor. That's been taken over by cultural evolution, and that is in the hands of mankind, which of course is the most unique animal on the earth and is the direct result of about 3,000 years of natural selection, but has emerged as a factor in determining further development rather than being a result of a particular kind of pattern of development like natural selection. And I'll deal with that when I deal with Darwin, Wallace and natural selection. Now, that's about all I've got to say on this particular subject. It's been a bit sketchy, but there's such a lot that has to be left out. It's very, very difficult to determine in the short time that we have what there is to leave out. But I hope that you've got a general idea of the process that took place. You had a development from Eocene times, a hangover from the period, the reptile period, the Mesozoic era, and the development of primitive mammals. The primates developed from primitive from mammals. They developed along certain lines, largely with the expansion of the brain, the rapid and enormous expansion of the brain, relatively. The other attributes which determined them not being specialized, but were enabled them to overcome problems with the use of the brain, and with the other attributes that the brain was a corollary to, and the development through lemuroid and tarsioid creatures to unspecialized apes, the division of the unspecialized apes into a pongoid line on the one hand and a hominid line on the other, which occurred round about the Miocene about 40 million years ago. And the progression in the hominid line, the apes, of course, became specialized and stagnated into the modern apes. The hominid line developed through Australopithecus, through Homo erectus, to Neanderthal man. And Neanderthal man developed, on the one hand, a group which became specialized and became extinct long before the group that was for a time contemporary with modern man, Cro-Magnon, Homo sapiens. So that's all I've got to say. If you want to have any questions, okay.
Can I just ask you about, you said it seems to be 7,000 years since the Neolithic age began. Is that the result of the most recent research? Because
one
child estimated it at 13,000. He admits that that's a generous estimate, but he's been dead for over 20 years, you know. But that is the most recent figure.
Well, it varies. You see, I mean, most of these discussions are academic in character.
Yes.
I say most of them advisedly because I did mention Raymond Dart, who was an anthropologist of very high standing, like Conrad Lorenz, but his conclusions are far different, for example, than the conclusions arrived at by anthropologists like Louis Leakey or Richard Leakey, a number of other well-known anthropologists, and particularly the modern school of anthropology, which drew entirely different conclusions. But as far as what we've discussed, or at least what we've talked about this evening, most of this is factual matter, which, give or take 1,000 years here or there, or give or take a difference in opinion about the age of a jawbone or a tooth,
and the exact time,
that's a matter of academic conjecture and difference of opinion. But generally speaking, the main contentions, the establishment of a species, in fact, they've been systematized into, got a list of them here, into a number of definite species with a chronological time scale and so on.
I'm only thinking of it in relation to civilization and the development of it and so on. That makes the Neolithic age even shorter, didn't it? I mean, if you think of it, if it appears to have started 7,000 years ago rather than 13,000.
Well, you see, all these cultures overlapped, and they were found sometimes in different deposits in different geographical areas. But there is a general sequence of events, an overall general sequence of events. And, of course, there's quite a lot of misconception about evolution in relation to man. There's all sorts of misconception, and there's, I must say, not a great deal of knowledge about it. I mean, most people don't go back much further than what they call the Old Stone Age. They always talk about the Old Stone Age. Well, the Old Stone Age, relatively speaking, is in modern times.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Pleistocene period, geologically, is modern times. But, of course, when you're dealing with time scale of 5,600 million years, then 3 million years is like a flash of light. You see, so there are differences of opinion, but no anthropologist would deny the general general consensus of opinion about Mosterian man, about Homo erectus, and all the rest of it, because there's been quite a lot of discovery made and quite a lot of work has been done by people that have been trained in that particular field, so that quite a lot of factual matter, which is indisputable in the main, anyway. Any other questions?
Can I ask why the Neanderthals were
Neanderthals?
Why were they Did Neanderthal man split into a specialised Neanderthal man and an ordinary Neanderthal man? And why did the specialised one sort of become extinct?
Well, it's not too difficult to explain, but it's something which I was going to reserve to the discussion about natural selection, which includes genetics. But if I can answer the question, seeing that you've answered it, the fact is that genetically, what occurs is variation. There are a sequence of mutations occurring. And as a matter of fact, it's been ascertained that they have an average occurrence in all organisms. But these mutations, most of which are deleterious, they're not useful at all, not adaptable, and they are quickly eliminated. But there are other adaptations which are beneficial or appear to be beneficial and adaptable. Now, you know, of course, that there was a period of some 125 million years where the dinosaurs appeared and dominated the world, and they were faced with various adaptations which were the result of environmental changes. Some of these have not been correctly ascertained. There's a lot of conjecture about what they were, but the fact is that they tended to develop aberrant qualities which led more to their extinction. In other words, they put on heavier armor, they developed more and more of the factors which were determining their extinction. Now, obviously, what occurred with Neanderthal man was that one line of evolution developed on the lines of being heavier built and more adapted, say, to the kind of weather conditions and so on. And the other line developed towards, more towards the use of the central nervous system, which is a hominid factor. And consequently, you had two lines of development in much the same way as in the Miocene period, where the unspecialized apes gave rise to two distinct lines of descent. One was the hominid line that developed towards greater brain capacity, the ability to stand more upright, improvements in vision and things like that, and the other towards a more specialized arboreal ape character, which resulted in the modern ape. Now, the modern ape is a prisoner in its ecological niche, and its biological attributes determine that it's got to live a certain specialized existence dependent upon forest conditions. And of course, if and when those forest conditions disappear, then all of the factors are there for the extinction of a species. Now, man, the way that mankind developed was on the principle of being unspecialized, but of using a greater intelligence, so that man was not confined to a certain ecological niche. Mankind is a very, very plastic kind of an animal, and the adaptability is on the basis of a cultural one. And needless to say, at the present time, I mean, man has been on the earth not much longer at the outside of 3 million years, taking into account that we are going to regard Homo erectus and Neanderthal man as men, as mankind, rather, no longer than about 3 million years. But all the indications are that at the present time, it doesn't seem that he's going to last anything like the dinosaurs who existed for 125 million years, because it seems to me that the difficulty, as I see it, is this, that there is definitely a speed up in man's adaptability. There has been, of course, a speed up in the evolutionary process overall, but there have developed very, very serious social contradictions which have got a very, very serious present a very, very serious situation to human society. I mean, there's no doubt about it that it doesn't appear that man is going to use his superior intelligence to construct a social organization which will determine him as a species lasting for thousands and thousands of years to come. All of the attributes are there. It's the question of the social relationships. And this, of course, is where we come in as far as society is concerned. Now, those people that claim that man's behavior is determined genetically and use evolution to try and prove that that is the case, to show that man cannot be other than what his behavior expresses or leads people to think that he is. In other words, human behavior is so closely related to what is called human behavior that there's no differentiation, and human behavior is supposed to be human nature. But of course, we do know that the plasticity of human behavior is one of the main attributes of mankind, and that man can behave in a number of different ways. It's very, very hard to put over sometimes, because we've witnessed some 10,000 or even 13,000 years, if you're you know, according to Child, but even 13,000 years, we've witnessed intraspecific inhumanity of the most appalling kind, and not least of all the 20th century. So the inference is that, well, this is how man behaves, there's nothing you can do about it. Now, that's why, in order to refute these ideas, and the refutations of these ideas will come later as far as I'm concerned, but before you can start refuting these ideas, which are based, I mean, the new social Darwinism is being put forward by people who are recognized as eminent scientists now, in the main, or some of them are. Conrad Lorenz, for example, was a man. He's since dead some few years ago, but he was a man with a worldwide reputation as an ethologist. The other people, Robert Ardrey and Desmond Morris, well, I would say that they're more likely to be the charlatans than Lorenz is, because Ardrey, for example, was a playwright and he didn't necessarily have a good grounding in anthropology or anything like that.
He had a degree in biology, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he took that afterwards, yes. But even so, even granting that he had a degree in this, that and the other, and all of them were more than lay people in relation to their knowledge, nevertheless, their interpretation is one which we have to oppose, because if we accepted their interpretation, then as far as trying to get a new order of society, you may as well wrap up. I mean, it wouldn't be on, because the inference is that man does what his genetic structure determines him doing. Well, we don't accept that, and in order to combat that, you've got to know and you've got to be able to discuss the question in their terms, because it's in those terms, and they deal with evolution as well. Raymond Dart, for example, was a supporter of the Lorenz school, so that it's necessary to have at least a general idea of what has taken place. Now, the fact is that although mankind is the direct descendant not only of anthropoid apes, but of all the organisms that went before, You can't therefore say that man is only a naked ape, or man is only an elephant. All this reductionist thinking is entirely erroneous, in my view, because what is not taken into consideration, but is pointed out by quite a number of other anthropologists, is that you have an entirely new factor coming into operation. And that is a factor which divides man from the lower animals. It's a completely new factor. You can't say, well, man is the result of natural selection, but mankind supersedes natural selection. That's my way of looking at it. And I think that that's the only way that you can argue the case.
Can I, Harry, I don't know if I'm too early.
I'll take you next,
Along the line of evolution, but I would have thought a very important thing must pose when man started possibly speaking. That must be a big solution to his problem.
Well, that is bound up largely with the development of man as a hunter. But you see, it's a quite a complicated process, because along with the social factors which determine speech developing, the cooperative methods of getting food, which hunting is, the need to communicate may have started off with sign language.
Does it come before thinking?
No, that's what I'm saying. You see, you can't separate the separation. You can't separate them, because you see, physiologically, an ape can't speak. It hasn't got the structure to speak. You see, it's prevented by the skull and the position of the larynx and so on. It's not possible biologically to speak.
So it can't think.
But an ape, to a limited extent, is capable of understanding sign language. There were some experiments carried out by some American anthropologists and ethologists upon a chimpanzee, trying to get it to speak. Well, in 3 years, they accomplished a vocabulary of about 3 words. But when they switched to sign language, which gives an indication that the areas of the brain for understanding language are to some limited extent developed in the anthropoid ape, they were more successful. What you've got to recognize is this, that the attributes of modern man are such that he has physiologically the ability for speech, he has an advanced conceptual thinking process which other animals haven't got. And consequently, a member of Homo sapiens at the age of 10 can acquire grammatically and as far as vocabulary is concerned, far greater vocabulary than an ape would ever acquire if it learned for thousands of years. So that it's not of any great significance. All that illustrates, as far as I'm concerned, is what we've been trying to illustrate here, that man is of the order of anthropoidea. But you see, there's a further division into hominidea and pongida. In other words, although man belongs to the order of generalized apes, there is a further division of separating man into hominids, and the other section into into modern anthropoid apes. In other words, you can't say that men evolved from anthropoid apes. He didn't. Anthropoid apes are the result of a certain line of development way back in the Miocene period, in the same way as the hominid line is hominid development also from the Miocene period.
Would that be the greatest contribution to the size of the brain when man begins to formulate speech communication? I mean, in the true sense of the word thinking, I don't think that real thinking can take place. Any reasoning as such can really take place until speech and language is developed. Communication.
Well, this is not the case, you see.
Well, it's a question of qualities of thought, isn't it? I mean, I would think that abstract thinking is impossible if you can't speak. Abstract thinking of the kind of human beings have.
Well, you see, the fact of the matter is that an anthropoid ape has got perceptive reasoning, but a very, very limited conceptual reasoning. It has some, because otherwise you wouldn't have made any progress at all in the concept of sign language. So that it's an indication that there are factors which associate man with an anthropoid ape, but the division is in on the question of the quality.
But can I get in here? This sign language, as far as I understand it, was near enough a parity that the apes that were taught this never got beyond what they were talking. In other words, they couldn't put two and two together. They couldn't extend on this. If you taught them that Charlie was a good boy by doing this, you know, that's all Charlie ever done.
They did in fact communicate with each other. I had this story about
this. Yeah, so they communicated.
It's not true to say that. You see, as a matter of fact, there was a very, very limited, there was a limited development of conceptual thought. But as far as is known, neurologically, an ape's brain is not capable of any great conceptual thoughts. The structure isn't there. You see, it's not only in the size of the brain, but it's in the quality of the brain, the convolutions of the brain. And that's why endocranial casts are very, very useful, because they can illustrate whether the brain was of a good quality, of an advanced quality or not. Now, an ape's brain is more undifferentiated. A human brain is convoluted to a much greater extent. And that, the corollary that's been drawn, is that the convolutions also help to determine the capacity of the brain, because obviously the neurological areas are much greater. When you've got something convoluted, there's a greater area than if it were just flat. I remember listening to the Reith lectures by Colin Blakemore. Now, Colin Blakemore dealt with this question, neurological question, in relation to genetics. He pointed out that the main factor which differentiated human beings from the lower animals was in the superior quality of the brain, and the possibility of mankind constructing ideas and abstract ideas of something in the future, of having that kind of memory and that kind of application, so that a man can construct a building in his head and then put it down on paper. Now, an ape can't do anything like this. There's no other animal that can do this kind of thing. And I mean, you can experiment till doomsday It's just not possible.
See, the one thing I haven't
because done, there's the biological attributes are not there.
Yeah.
That's the point.
The one seems to know what it's doing.
Pardon?
The bee is aware of what it's doing.
No, the bee is not aware of what it's doing. Now that is something. You see, what you're proposing now, the bee is a social animal in much the same way as an ant is a social animal. But the fact is that ants and bees, their social organization is determined genetically. Certain numbers genetically of worker bees are produced, certain numbers of queen bees, and so on and so forth. And that is largely a question of being determined instinctively. So that the bees are doing exactly the same thing as they've been doing for millions and millions of years. Millions of years. Stretching right back into way back in the geological periods.
They're like birds building nests.
Yes. The fact is that what is significant about hominid evolution is that as the brain enlarges and gets of much advanced quality, so instinct falls away. So that mankind has no use of instinct. It's of no survival use. You see, mankind can think and adapt himself to the environment. He doesn't have to have any predetermined patterns at all. In fact, man is the only animal that can adapt to rapid changes. Other animals can't because the genetic rate of evolution is so slow. It took 60 million years for a horse, from a small horse about that size up to the present modern horse, to develop. 60 million years. And a fractional modification in the dentition of a horse took about 3,000 years to effect. So that natural selection, on the whole, although it varies because it sometimes leaps forward at a greater rate. But natural selection on the whole, on the average, is far too slow. Man could never adapt himself to the modern world dependent upon biological attributes as such. Man is able to use his intelligence and construct machines which take the place of wings and claws and armor and so on. So that the main factor in evolution is obviously man, because man has in his hands all the other animals. Mankind is destroying most of the other animals. And I'm not saying that I'm agreeing with it, but I'm just pointing out that there are no other animals that are in a position to question in any way or to oppose the superior position of mankind, because mankind is in a superior biological and genetic position. Now, you had a question. I don't want to leave you out because...
What I've got to say, down in Tenerife and Santa Cruz, that there's a museum of archaeology.
Yeah.
As they're putting the autopista through, that's a motor road, they discovered an old cemetery. Now, the former people that was there were the Guaranches. When the Spaniards went there in the 1600s, apparently they did a good slaughter. Probably there was a bit of interbreeding before that even happened. But if you go in there, you see mummies where they've taken up all these skulls and skeletons and everything. You've got the mummies all around the wall. You can see all that in Santa Cruz. That's what I've got to say.
Yeah, that's in more modern times, though, isn't it? I say that is in more modern times. That would be... Archaeology is largely in the period of civilization.
There's another thing I would say. Isn't human being, even in some cases where they've been destructive, they also preserved animals? Because they got all these reservations and all that, even our zoos.
Well, if you're saying that primitive man apparently was more mindful of his environment than modern man, then I think that that's substantially true. Because those groups of people that are still living as Paleolithic man did are very, very mindful of their environment and do much to preserve it. The pygmies, for example, don't overhunt or overgather in the forest. They don't destroy the forest in any way. They realize that the forest is their home and their sustenance, and they treat it accordingly. Modern man doesn't do that, doesn't seem to consider, well, under the circumstances, of course, it's a matter of doing what a set of social relationships dictate. That is largely the position. It's not a question, for example, of standing by and seeing millions of people die of starvation when there are possibilities of producing food. It's not that kind of a behaviour. It's a behaviour determined by the fact that food is produced for sale with a view to profit. But given a community of interests, it is the community that is considered, along with every one of its individuals. That's why in the Zaire forests, the two groups of pygmies that are there, that have been studied, can't think of the man now who, anyway, they've been studied quite extensively recently by anthropologists in the field. Colin Turnbull, that's the man I'm trying to think of, an American anthropologist, spent a number of years studying the pygmies, and of course he concludes that none of the behaviour that you get in modern society can be found in that community. Of course, it's a much more simple community on a much more primitive scale of production and so on, but nevertheless it illustrates that human beings can behave differently. So it shows the plasticity of man, because a pygmy is no less a member of Homo sapiens than we are. Except in size.
Yeah, well, you see, the size is relative. And that's what I would like to come to, because I would sort of a question, you know, not that you know, it couldn't be valid, but a question you, when you mention, you see, that man is a species on his own, you know, when you make the comparison with the primates, yet we are related. Well, when did it become a species of his own? That's the question. Now, I would say, when did it start? And if he was always a species on his own, when they crawled out of the sea, when he was very, very small, and you've related, you know, that the millions of years for the horse, you know, to come from, say, that size. Who knows, was it smaller, you know, was it an insignificant size when it crawled out of the sea, you get what I'm getting, from the time, you know, man was a species, and he came out of the sea, whatever size he was, and he grew, are you saying, going as far back as that, he was always a different species?
No, what I am saying is, you see, what you've got to recognise is this, that the way a species is developed is that, and this really I'm encroaching upon another discussion, but anyway, seeing that you've posed the question, there are variations which occur determined by a mutation in the gene structure of an organism. And if those variations are adaptable to survival, that is, if the organism with new attributes can obtain more food and leave a greater number of offspring than the others, then the tendency would be for that organism to survive. Now, this doesn't alter the fact that other organisms have been left behind in particular ecological niches, but what it does show is that new species have gradually developed from old species, but they become a species. As a matter of fact, very hard to define a species. It's a homogeneous group of people with characteristics that are in alignment, except for small variations like height and so on. But a species becomes genetically isolated. In other words, when a new species is formed, with one or two exceptions, it can't mate successfully. In other words, it can't mate with another similar species and produce offspring that are capable of procreating on a fertile basis. In other words, if a mule, which is between a horse and a donkey, the result is a mule. But a mule is sterile, is a sterile hybrid, you see, so that there is a genetic isolation. Now, I don't know exactly what you mean by crawling out of the sea. I thought that I spent a considerable, in fact, more time than was warranted, must have been very boring to some people, in going through the succession of life in geological time. And I was able to illustrate that the first animal organism was a simple, single-celled organism. In Precambrian times, which has been given the name of a prokaryote cell. That is a simple protoplasmic cell that multiplied by simple division without a nucleus carrying chromosomes and genes. Now, there was a revolution that took place. When that occurred, I don't think anybody is certain. It's a conjecture, because you're dealing with millions of years, and I mean you're dealing with long dead animals. As a matter of fact, it was only by the development